Thank you. Do I need to turn this microphone up or anything? You've got that in charge. Well, thank you very much. My name's Owen, and I'm a grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon. And thanks to the committee for asking me to come and share my experience, strength, and hope. I'll share what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now, because it suggests that I share what we were like, what happened, and what we're like now. And it says in here, in the Al-Anon Works for Families and Friends of Alcoholics, my story is like anyone else's story, because when alcoholism strikes, the feelings are the same, the fear of anger, the hopelessness, and the helplessness are all the same. And I'm standing here at 62 years of age. I only have gray hair from that side looking this way. When I look in the mirror, it's a chestnut brown. And I've been here about 20 years. And I was born in a small town down in Mission, down in the Fraser Valley, a farming community back in the day. And until I got up here to Salmon Arm, I had never seen so many dirty pickup trucks in my life. But I grew up in a small town with a normal family. A mom, a dad, and a brother. My brother's 2.5 years older than me. And we moved to Mission from Langley when I was 4 years old. And we had a normal life. Except in hindsight. But even at the time, looking back, and in those times of childhood, I never felt like I fit in anywhere. I had this ugly pit in my stomach that I didn't belong anywhere. I didn't fit in, and I never knew why. Our first 4 years of my life, I remember little bits of it. I remember being chased by the big kids in the neighborhood. And then when we moved to Mission, we lived on a dirt road, and you could look up and see the monastery. And we had a big house on a dirt road with two cars in the driveway, and it looked normal to everybody else. And it was a normal growing up, you know. We had food on the table, had a father that drank, but then in our minds, everybody drank. Tip it up. You're welcome. And so growing up, just believing that everything was normal, because that's all it is when you're a child. It's all we knew. I grew up, I got to grade 3, and our family has legends. We don't just have a little story. We have these family legends that carry on for generations. And the first one that I remember was my mom telling it. She said when I was in grade 3, all the kids in the neighborhood. Now, this was not a big neighborhood, so all the kids, sounds like hundreds, but it was probably 5 or 6. But they all ran back after school saying, "We had an eye test today and Owen can't read the big E." And so that became a family legend. And my mom, being in public health, she'll tell the story. Well, she's passed away now, but when she'd tell it, and she told it continually till the day she died, that Owen couldn't read the big E. And the other kids in the neighborhood came running home. I don't remember any of the other kids saying anything about it, but I do remember my mom carrying on with that story. Bless her heart. But I ended up getting glasses in grade 3, and the eye doctor back in the day, we drove from Mission into Vancouver to see an eye doctor, which was about an hour, a day off of school. It was great, a great adventure. But that eye doctor sitting 40 feet away in his desk, I'm reading the eye chart, he's talking to my mother, and he's saying, "Does Owen like to play sports?" And my mom's saying, "No, he doesn't like to play sports." He said, "Well, he never will once he gets glasses either." And the doctor says, "Does he like to swim? Can he swim?" And mom says, "Oh, he loves to swim." He said, "Well, that's good, because now that he'll have glasses, he wouldn't take them off to learn." And I heard those words, and I spent the rest of my life living up to not playing sports well, not playing sports at all. Living up being that kid in school that was the last picked for the team. Until the day the teacher back then realized that I was always last, he decided to make me the captain of one of the two teams. So I did what any good little codependent kid would do. I picked the toughest kid to be my first pick, and then I let him take over. And so on life went. We lived in Mission. My dad's family lived in Langley, about an hour's drive away. And we'd go over maybe once a month to have dinner with my dad's family. And as we'd hop in the car, and Dad would drive, my brother would sit in the front seat, my mom would sit in the back seat, and Owen, I would sit in the back seat. And we learned that the reason for that is because my brother and I fought. And we fought brutally. And we couldn't sit in the back seat together. In fact, my mom would say, you know, if you kids didn't fight so much, your father wouldn't mind taking more vacations. If you quit fighting, we're going to stop the car and put you out. We heard that one more than once. But anytime we went on a family outing for the day or whatever, mom would always drive home. And I didn't understand at 7, 8 years old why mom was always driving home, except for your father's tired. And I didn't understand why mom pulled the car over to the shoulder of the road and dad could open his door for a minute, because I didn't know tired meant you had to get sick, but that's what that was. So I grew up learning that. And I grew up hating. For me, the disease of alcoholism is a disease of anger, which I try and control now. But I hated my brother growing up with a passion. I hated him so much. And in my home, mom and dad would go out somewhere, my brother and I'd be home, and we'd fight. And the neighbors would hear us, and we'd hear stories from the neighbors about our fighting. And they were all true. And we would fight. And my brother, being older and bigger than me, would lose. Because I would chase him around the house, I'd chase him up the stairs, he'd get to his bedroom, he'd slam his bedroom door, and I'd pound on it. You're in there and I'm coming in to kill you, I'd say. And he'd say, oh, you're not, just settle down, go away. So I'd go away. I'd go downstairs to the kitchen, open the kitchen drawer, grab the butcher knife, and I'd run back up the stairs and I'd pound on his door and I'd say, I'm coming in there to kill you and I've got the butcher knife this time. And he'd say, you have not. And I'd wave it under the door at him. I'd say, oh yeah, I've got the butcher knife and you're done. And you get a laugh or two from that, you know, but you can't tell that story anywhere else. Because they come at you from the other side of the room with jackets. And he'd say to my mom the next day, Owen chased me with the butcher knife again. And my mom would say, you know, you shouldn't do that. And that's all she ever said. You see, what was going on in our home was the family disease of alcoholism. And nobody knew it, and nobody understood it. And we'd continue fighting. We don't fight anymore as adults because we don't speak. And that's sad enough. But we would continue fighting all through childhood. And I would be the angry one. You know, if you were to look at our house back in the day, and I've heard it said in these rooms, if you wonder who the alcoholics are on the street, don't look for the drinker, look for what the family members are doing. Because we were fighting. There was a time when I couldn't get in the house. I got home from school and the door was locked. And it was usually never locked. And if it was locked, the basement door was open. And that one was locked too. And that's okay because the key is in the doghouse. Well, the key wasn't in the doghouse. Well, that's okay because if you put the ladder up to the second story, the laundry room window is never locked. Well, I got up to the second story and that laundry room window was locked. So I can't get in the house. And I'm probably 13 years old. And about a week later, the neighbor from about 2 blocks away said to me when I ran in, saw her, and she said, I hear you were pretty upset last week. I said, what do you mean? Well, I could hear you over here. What was going on at your place? I said, oh, nothing. See, I was stood up on the roof yelling at the world that I was locked out of the house. Because I could go from zero to anger in a flash. So we grew up. Life carried on. Went to high school. I didn't fit in there either. I became a teenager. Learned to fit in a bit better with a select group of friends. We'd always stop at this one friend's place on a Friday or Saturday night because his parents had a summer place and they'd go away. And I had a car by then, or my mother's car, whichever happened to be in the driveway, and I'd be there. And it was years later, I can remember running into Donnie and him saying, it was a Sunday, and we were watching Saturday Night Live, was on a Sunday. And he said to me, I said, wow, this is a funny show. He said, we always used to watch it on Saturday nights back when we were kids, don't you remember? Oh, no, he said, you'd pass out by then, because we'd always pass around a little bit of, I think, what's now called recreational marijuana. We thought recreation back then was playing soccer, but... And so I would eat the pizza and pass out, and then I'd drive home. And my dad had taught me, as a good father would, you drive home, you take the back road home. And when I was about 18 or 19, I can remember my car being in the driveway, and my father hopped in my car to go downtown one day. And he came back and he said, son, we need to talk. I said, what's up? He said, well, I borrowed your car. I said, yes, I noticed. He said, well, you have a Mickey of Rye under the front seat of your car. And I was like, oh, God. And he said, pardon me, he said, that's very dangerous. And I'm thinking he's going to really give it to me. And what he said was, you know, it is dangerous to keep a bottle under the seat of your car. When you hit the brakes, it could come out and screw up your feet, and you might miss the brakes. So you need to keep it in your glove compartment or in the trunk. And see, that's what growing up with a father that drinks teaches. And all that was going on in our family was the family disease of alcoholism. My father was a good man, you guys taught me. I hated my father when I grew up. I didn't understand that I hated him. I just didn't want to be around him. And yet at the same time, I loved being with him. Now that's a confusion for a small boy. My father ran the lumber yard in Mission, and he would often say, look, on Saturday, I'm going across the river, which is how we referred to it in those days, and I'm going over to Langley or Cloverdale, and I've got to put a lumber order in. Would you like to come with me? And I'd be like 10, 11 years old, and I'd say, oh, I'd love to. So I'd hop in the car, and we'd head off for the day, and through the course of that day, it would always end up that he would end up in the other manager's office. The toilet tank lid would come off and a bottle would come out and they would drink. And I'd be given a dime to go and get a Coke and a chocolate bar or whatever. And then on the way home, he'd say to me, now don't tell your mother. So I learned how to keep secrets at a very young age. We'd drive home, and if we were, depending on what side of the river we were on, if you're familiar with down near the Pitt Meadows there, there used to be the Wild Duck Inn. And I've sat in that parking lot a few times when my father had just had to go in and use the washroom. I wasn't abandoned in the car for any more than a few minutes. But I didn't understand till I was about 20-something that you could stop at a gas station and use a washroom. We always stopped outside some tavern and my father could run in and go to the washroom. And I met a bartender in my 20s that I shared that with once, and she said, oh, is that what those guys were doing? I said, what do you mean? Well, I get some regulars. They come in, and they throw down some money on the counter and say, quick, put up a glass of beer or a quick shot of whiskey. I'll just be right back. They run into the washroom, come back, down it, and out the door they go. I said, oh, I didn't realize that either. But, you know, that was just my father. He was a loving man. He loved his son. He loved his family. He was just trapped in the family disease of alcoholism, and he was the drinker. I got to be in this program at the age of 40. I got here at the urging of a doctor and a friend. I had been visiting my brother in New West, where I lived at the time, still live, and my brother was angry, and he said to me this day, he said, you know, I was out at Mom and Dad's on the weekend, I made a nice dinner for them. He said, you need to go out there and talk to our father. I said, why? He said, well, he's always drunk. He said, he won't come and have dinner that I've made. And I said, well, Mom had cancer last year and you weren't angry. Dad's probably an alcoholic and you're mad as hell. What's going on? And he said, no, he is not. And I didn't know what to say. And I went home that day, and on my bookshelf there was a little skinny book, which was about families of, can't remember the title now, but it was about drinking, and a friend of mine that I'd lived with about 10 years before that, who was an alcoholic in AA, had handed me this little pamphlet to read one day, and he said, "Here, this is my background. You might find it interesting." And I remember reading that book when he first gave it to me, and I read it, and I thought, oh, the poor bastard. I can't imagine growing up with that. And then this 10 years passes, and I take it off the shelf, and I read it, and I think, oh, my God, that explains a lot to me. So I phoned him up, and I said, that book that you gave me years ago, and I said, I'm pretty sure my dad fits into that category, and so do I. And I said, what do I do? And he said, well, I suggest you go to Al-Anon. I also suggest there's a doctor in New West here that's an addiction specialist. Go and see him. So I've made an appointment with this doctor, and I phoned up the doctor's office, and I said, it's Owen, I'd like to make an appointment. And the receptionist said, oh, you haven't been in here for about 7 years. And I realized I had seen that doctor about 7 years prior. And I'd seen that doctor, the first time I saw him, I'd been working out in the gym, and I dropped a 45-pound weight on my ankle, and it ballooned up, and I needed to see a doctor. And a friend of mine knew this doctor, and he would see a new patient. So I went in to see him, and he treated my ankle. And I didn't like him in the beginning, because when he treated my ankle, he wouldn't prescribe painkillers or prescriptions or nothing for pain, and people sitting in his office were kind of dodgy characters. And so I didn't go back to him after my ankle healed, but then this 7 years later, I go back to him, and he's a specialist in the disease of alcoholism. And the same characters were still sitting in his waiting room, and they were nice people. And so he said, you know, welcome. And he said, you know, what brings you here? And I said to him, well, I think my father came home from the Second World War an alcoholic. And he said to me, if your father's an alcoholic, he didn't come home from the war an alcoholic. He was born an alcoholic, and the disease has just come up in him. So let's find out where you fit in this. And so he gave me about a lot of tests, verbal tests and questionnaires, and he said, I think you need to go to Al-Anon. And he handed me a brochure of meetings, and I started going to Al-Anon. And I kept seeing this doctor. And one day I'm seeing this doctor, and I'm driving to see him, and I got to his office, and I was white as a ghost. Probably because I was nervous like I am standing here now, but that's okay. And I get there, and he said to me, how are you today? And I said, oh, I'm fine. And he said, well, what's going on? And I said, well, nothing. He said, well, what's going on with you? I said, well, on my drive here, the part of the road, I was coming along, and a big tractor and trailer, 45-footers coming towards me, and he swerved over the center line, and the trailer swayed, and I kind of thought he was going to hit me. And I can remember thinking, God, I hope he doesn't hit me. And this doctor said to me, and tell me more. I said, well, that's the first moment in my life where I've had a reason to live. And I'm not sure what the reason is yet, but until then, I was hoping I'd get killed. I had spent 40 years of my life wanting to be dead, wanting to die. And I said to him, does that make me suicidal? And he said, well, passively suicidal, because if you were aggressively suicidal, you'd have marks on you or you'd have had hospital admissions, but not a healthy place. And from that day till this, I've never had that dark thought or feeling since. And the only difference is I started going to Al-Anon and working the 12 steps. So I got to meetings, and you guys said to me, when you get here, get a sponsor. And somebody said to me, get a sponsor in your first 30 days. Now, that was pretty harsh words for me. It took me 6 weeks. And I knew that, and I was really annoyed at myself for taking so long. But I asked this fellow who was, as in his words, he was a double winner. And that was good for me. He since passed away. But he said, now we're going to go through the steps. And we started on the steps. And we got to said step four, he says, okay, take a scribbler and write down 0 to 5 and 5 to 10 and all the years of your life and start writing about what was going on. And then you come back and share it with me. And he said, in 2 weeks from now, you're heading to California on your own. I said, yep. And he said, well, then on the way down, you can start. On the way back, you can finish. Come and see me when you get home. And I said, well, I've been going to meetings. It takes longer than that to do a fourth step. He says, not when you're working with me, it doesn't. Get on with it. So I did. And I took it to him and we read it. And he just said, nothing I haven't heard before. And then he said to me, tell me again why you're coming to Al-Anon. I said, well, I think my father has a problem drinking. And he said to me, does he spill his drinks? I said, no. He said, then I suggest he doesn't have a problem with drinking. I suggest you have a problem with the fact that he drinks. And that's none of your business now. He said, you grew up in a home with a drinking father. And he says, I hate to tell you this, but in a home with alcohol, kids are in the way. But you're not a kid anymore, so now you can grow from it. So he taught me one day at a time how to grow from that and how to have relationships. It is a disease of a lack of relationships in this program. And we're learned to have relationships. My sponsor was a real blessing to me. He said to me when he first got sober in AA, and then he joined Al-Anon. He'd been sober 40 years, I suppose, and in Al-Anon 20 years before he passed. And he said when he was first in AA, his kids would go to AA meetings with him. And he said, you know what my kids call alcoholics? I said, I don't know. He said, well, those are people that go to meetings and drink coffee. The others are drinkers. And he said, your father's a drinker. He says, I've known people that have drank their whole life. They've had one drink every night after work their whole life. He says, I've known other people that have never touched alcohol for 90 years. So those are different scenarios. I hadn't been long in Al-Anon, and I went to a lot of open AA meetings, listened to a lot of AA speakers, and I'd hear the stories, some of those war stories. And I'd think, God, in my 20s, I did that kind of stuff. And I remember my home group sharing one night that I was struggling in my first couple of years when I'd hear those stories is, you know, do I belong in AA or Al-Anon? And a guy came up to me after my meeting, and he said to me, and I can still picture him, I can't remember his name, but it doesn't matter, but he said to me, Owen, you belong in Al-Anon. I said, how do you know? He said, well, you shared tonight that when you went traveling for a year, you packaged up your apartment, you stored it for a year when you went away, and you talked about those boxes of wine, those boxes of half bottles of vodka, gin, and rum that you put in storage for a year. That's what an Al-Anon member would do, he said. I have never put a half a bottle of alcohol in storage. I threw the cap away and drank it. He said, do you have a copy of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, yes, it was given to me early in the program. He said, well, in there it talks about, and I'll paraphrase the best I can, he says it talks about alcoholics, big drinkers, and teetotalers, I think it is. He said, I suggest the family you grew up in taught you how to drink, but you're not an alcoholic. I remember I was working out in the gym with this trainer I had when we dropped the weight. I think he threw it at me, but he said to me one Monday in the gym, he said, so what'd you do on the weekend? He was starting to monitor my diet and stuff. And I said to him, well, I went out for dinner with friends and we went to this club. And he said, and what'd you drink? What'd you eat? Did you have anything to drink? And I said, oh yeah, a couple of beers. And he said, that's it? I said, well, we were dancing, so a couple of beers, a couple of bourbon, a few glasses of water. Okay, he wrote it all down. The next Friday, he said, so what are you doing this weekend? I said, oh, kind of the same as last. He said, well, don't eat so much, monitor your diet, and maybe pick one, just have one beer when you go out. I said, well, why would you bother? But, you know, that was okay. I had a box of wine. I'd learned how to cook watching The Galloping Gourmet. And you just took a glass of wine while you cooked. So I had this box of wine sitting in the fridge. So my trainer at the time said, you know, we're changing your diet. So I took that box of wine and I put it on the shelf and it went bad. And I threw it away about 3 months later. And that's again how this guy knew that I belonged in Al-Anon. He said, no, you don't let stuff like that go bad. So I kept going to Al-Anon. I got to meetings twice a week. My home group now is Edgemont Men's in North Vancouver. I didn't need that drink of water. I just got lost for a moment in time there. But I go to meetings twice a week. I have a sponsor. In fact, just before I came in here 15 minutes ago, I texted my sponsor and I said, I'm in Salmon Arm, I'm speaking in 15 minutes, and I must be present because I'm nervous. And he said, have fun. So the first time I texted him once, I was speaking somewhere, and I said to him, I'm speaking in 15 minutes, and I'm real nervous. And he phoned me back and said, that means you're present. So now I tell him I'm present. Because sponsors are great people. You know, there was a time when I turned 50, my wife and I planned a trip. We were going to fly to California, fly to San Francisco, rent a car, drive down to LA, fly home from LA. So I do the travel planning for my wife and I. We sit down and brainstorm it, and then I do the paperwork and the legwork, and that works well for us. And this trip, she said to me, look, since we're going to be driving down the California coast, let's rent a convertible. And then she said, and let's rent a red convertible. Well, I had already, in planning the trip, I had already booked our car, which was like $79 a week, and you couldn't fit a suitcase in it, but it was cheap. And so I phoned my sponsor, and I said to him, oh, we're planning this trip. Yes, he says, I know. I said, well, look, Linda wants me to try and rent a Mustang convertible and a red one. And I said, but they're $350 a week, and we need it for 2 weeks. And I went on and on and on. And he said to me, you know, I bet you if you asked the car company if you could have a red one, they'd get you a red one. I said, no, that's not why I'm phoning you. I need to know how to tell Linda that we want this other cheap one. And he repeated himself, I'm sure if you ask for a red one, if they can accommodate you, they will. So we got to San Francisco, and we got to the rental counter. And I can still remember the woman. I said, oh, we've got a reservation, and it's for a convertible. And she said, well, we have two here at the moment. We have this gray something or other convertible, or we have a red Mustang. Which would you like? I said, well, apparently we want the red Mustang. We'd only been in the car about 2 days, and I pulled over in a roadside stop, and I said to my wife, thank you. This is a lot of fun. This is fun driving this car with the top down in California. And that night I phoned my sponsor and I said, thank you, because Owen would never have done this by himself. And it would have been an argument with my wife and I. And she was impressed that I would stop and say thank you to her and then would thank my sponsor for that. So we rented that convertible. Now when we go on vacation, if we fly to California, and Linda's now at the point of saying, you know, we've done the Mustang convertible. We don't always have to rent one. And I said, oh yeah, they're great. We do. We do have to rent one because you drive along and you can smell the pine forest. And if you go past Kentucky Fried Chicken, you get to smell that too. And it's great. And if it rains, it's a rental. I mean, here we are, two tourists with jackets on, bundled up, and it's pouring rain on the freeway. But, you know, you can't put the top up when you're on the freeway because it doesn't work. And who wants to? And it's not going to rain that long anyway. And we bought the extra insurance, so. But that's what my sponsor does with me. I got asked a couple of years ago to go and speak somewhere, and I phoned him up, and I said, they've asked me to go and speak, and I really don't want to. And it means taking Friday off work. And on I went. And he said, let me know how it goes when you get back. Why do we have sponsors if they're not going to listen? You know? And yet they do listen, because I'm able to share that message with a fellow I sponsor who said to me a couple of years ago, and I asked him if I could share this, and he said yes. But he phoned me up one day, and he was all in a tither because him and his wife were flying to the Caribbean or somewhere, and they were going through an airport in the States, and they had to pick up their luggage at the first airport and take it to the next plane, because you have to do that in the States back then. And he said to me, and my wife's packing too much stuff. We've got two little kids, and she's packing two car seats and two strollers and on and on. And I said to him, you know, I've had that experience before, not with kids, but with other trips I've been on with scuba diving, and we've had too much gear. And I said, when you get to your first airport, I said, in fact, do it right now. While you're on the phone with me, stick your hand in your wallet and grab $20. He said, okay. He said, when you land in that airport, have that $20 in your pocket, and around the carousel of luggage, you'll see guys standing around with big dollies and maybe red caps, I think they call them in some airports. I said, walk over to them and hand them a $20 bill and said, I need help with my luggage. And they'll come over and get all your luggage for you, take you to your next connection. You won't wait in line because they got money to make. They'll put you right through as the first person in the checkout, and you'll be on your way. And now when you hang up, You can tell your wife, pack another suitcase if you want. I've got it figured out. And when he came home, he said, thank you. And I was able to share that with him because I had done a similar thing. And that had happened to a group of us when we traveled. And this group of people I was traveling with at the time thought I was a bit rude when they were dragging luggage off the carousel and I'm walking away. And I said to him, just leave it. I got this looked after. And I went over and hired a guy and I made them pay me. They said, what'd you give him? I said, I just gave him so much money. I think I made $2 on the deal, but it's okay. But you know, that's what the program does for me. It teaches me to live. It teaches me how to live a better life, working the steps. My wife and I went to Australia 18 years ago for a year, took a year off work, took a leave of absence. Halfway through the trip, got fired. But they fired 400 of us, and my wife says I got laid off. But I say they're not calling me back, so I'm pretty sure we're fired. But we were going to meetings around Australia. And we ended up in Perth, Australia, and we were at a roundup there. And a guy from AA came up to me and he said, I understand you're Canadians in Al-Anon traveling around. I said, yes. He said, well, I'm going to give you a suggestion. When you go north from Perth, there's not much Al-Anon, if any, and there's a lot of lone AA members as you go up the coast. Grab the meeting list from the AA office in Perth and phone them when you go through the towns. So we did that. We'd get to a small town. There'd be a payphone in the caravan park, and we'd pick up the phone. I'd call that one number, and a member would answer, and I'd say, Canadian in the Al-Anon program traveling through, and they'd say, well, here's our address. Come on over for dinner. And we'd go over for dinner. And they say, where are you heading next? And we tell them we were heading up the coast. Oh, he said, so-and-so lives up the coast in the next town you'll be at. I'll let her know you're coming. And we'd get to that town, phone up, stop in, and have dinner. We got to a place called 80 Mile Beach, Western Australia. Now, there was a name on the AA meeting list for a contact by a man named Colin. So I thought, well, we're a day away from getting there. I'll phone Colin. Say we're coming up to 80 Mile Beach. Since you live there, and that just sounds like a big beach town when you hear the name. And it's not even, there's no town. It's just 80 miles of beach. But he lives there, and I thought, this guy will know where we can camp on the beach for free and stay a week. So I phoned him up, and he answered, Colin, and I said, look, we're at Al-Anon members coming up that way. I understand there's an AA meeting on Saturday. We'd like to come, but we'd also wonder if there's a place we could bush camp on the beach for free. And he said, no, I don't think there's any, no places up here you can bush camp for free. I said, okay. So we carried along the road. And then I thought, gee, we should phone this. There's only one caravan park in 80 Mile Beach, too. We should phone and make a reservation. Yeah. So I phoned. And Colin answered the phone. 80 Mile Beach Caravan Park. I said, now I know why there's no place to camp for free, don't I? He said, yeah, looking forward to you getting here. But they were memorable, those people. There was about six people who worked in the caravan park, all members of AA. They welcomed us. They had a meeting Saturday night, the AA meeting at 80 Mile Beach with Al-Anon participation. And then the next day, this Jeep pulled up at the end of his work day, a man named John, who was 30-some years sober, and he said, welcome. And he stopped every day for 2 weeks at our trailer and had a cup of tea after work. And he taught me the meaning of fellowship. He said to me about halfway through when we were there, he said, you know, Owen, stopping in here every day and having a cup with you and going to a meeting, he said, this is fellowship. He said, I suspect if you live close here or near, over time we'd become friends. But we're sitting here today because of the fellowship of AA and Al-Anon. And that was huge. We'd been home a couple of years, and we sent him and his wife a Christmas card, my wife did, and we got it back from him saying, oh, I'm glad you sent me this because Judith passed away and I've lost all her contacts. And I'm coming through to Canada to go to the Calgary Stampede and I'd like to come and see you guys. Is there a hotel near you I can stay at? And we phoned him back and we phoned him and said, we've got a spare room here with us, so the spare bath, you're welcome to come and stay as long as you want. And so he come and stayed with us. And I remember saying to him then, he had run into Dot, which was another lady we met on that trip, when we were lost and our car had broke down and we phoned an AA member on the list and said, "Doc, our car's broke down and we're kind of lost in the middle of whoop whoop here. It's being towed into Alice Springs tomorrow, 1,000 miles from here. Do you know anybody that can help us out, or a mechanic or whatever?" And she said, "Call me back in an hour." I called her back and she said, "No, there's no mechanics, but there is a few car dealerships here. Take it to them, and how are you getting here?" And we said, "On the bus." And she said, "I'll meet the bus at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning and meet you there." So she picked us up off the bus, took us to a motel we'd be staying in, and then picked us up that night and took us to a meeting. We were there for a week, and she took us to a meeting every day. There was no Al-Anon in town, but we were welcome to AA meetings. And there was members leaving, and they had a big dinner, and we were welcome to that, too. And we carried on down the road. I remember saying, when John was visiting here, I was telling him that story, and he said to me, "Oh, Dot," he says, "she was at the roundup in Tasmania last month. We were talking about you Canadians." I said, "Well, you know, when we left town, I don't know that we properly thanked her for the hospitality." And he said to me, "I'm staying with you now, aren't I?" "That's thanks enough. That's all we need in this program," he said, "is just to extend our hand out when we can. You've done it for me. She'll do it again for you, and you'll do it again for others." So we got back to Canada, and I was unemployed. My wife had quit her job to go traveling. And my wife knows how to get a job. I mean, she takes the Vancouver, when there used to be a newspaper, and she'd cut out job ads, and she'd make herself a board up and put things on, and she'd send out resumes and make phone calls. And I would sit there looking out the window. Because Owen doesn't know how to get a job. The first job I got was working at a bulb farm on a farm when I was a kid, but I worked for a grocery industry. Started when I was 17 and lost the job when they restructured and fired us when we were in Australia. So I had never looked for it. I had never had a resume or a job interview in my life. So my wife got a job and I sat around thinking we'll just live off of what we're living off of. And my sponsor said to me, "Owen, I think you need to start looking for a job." Fortunately enough, he's in his line of work. He knows how to do that kind of stuff. So he helped me. And then my wife came home. My wife's brother-in-law, is a bus driver in Vancouver. And she'd be visiting her mom, and Linda'd come home, and she'd say, "Well, Ray, who's the brother-in-law, he says that transit's hiring bus drivers if you're interested." And I said, "Oh, that's nice," because I didn't want to be a bus driver. And a week later, it'd go by, and Linda'd say to me again, "You know, transit's still hiring bus drivers." And I'd say, "Good for transit." And then 3 weeks go by, my brother-in-law phones me, and he says, "I don't know if Linda's told you or not, but transit's hiring bus drivers." "Yes, I know." Thank God I had a sponsor, because he said to me, "You know, and I'd put that application in if I was you." I said, "I don't want to be a bus driver." He said, "You don't know what you want to be, but it's going to get your wife off your back, and you got to understand you're going to need a job one day." So I put the application in. About 6 or 8 months later, they phoned me, and they said, "We've got appointments next week. Can you make it?" I said, "Yeah, I'll be there." And I phoned my sponsor and I said, "What do I do?" He said, "Show up at the appointment." I mean, it's not rocket science, but it was for me. So I went to that appointment, and they said, "Okay, you studied, you did this testing," and you said, "Okay, come back to the next one next week." And I phoned my sponsor, and I kept going back. He said, "Keep doing what they're telling you, and keep going back." So I did that, and then they made me a job. They said, "We'd like to offer you a job." And I'm thinking, what should I ask for? And he said, "No, they're just going to tell you they're hiring you. You don't get to tell them what you want for a salary. That's all done." So I started bus driving. And I was only going to do that until the next job came along. And that's 16 years now. And I don't know when the next bus coming along or the next job's coming along, but I didn't like it. And I was, if you've ever get to Vancouver and hop on a bus and you've seen a bus driver going along and he's been miserable, that was me. And I'd be driving along Main and Hastings, which is the area we all know, and people be getting on the bus and they'd be going, "I need a free ride." And I'd say, "Well, not on my bus." And they'd walk past me anyway. And I would say, "Hey, don't let your pantyhose get caught in the back door when you leave." Or they'd stand there and say, can I have a free ride? And I'd say, not on my bus. You can follow my taillights, though, and I'll get you down the road. It was not pretty. And then 2 years ago, about, I was on Vancouver Island at a roundup, and I heard the words, which in these rooms we all have heard them before, and I heard the words, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length. And I've heard those words for 16 or 17 years, and they resonated with me. And I got back to work, and I walked into this other driver that I know, and I know her story, and I walked up to her, and I said, I want what you got. Because I said, you can get out behind the wheel and be calm and relaxed, and nothing fizzes you, does it? No. I said, I just get annoyed. I've had it. I can't handle these people that don't want to pay. And she'd say, well, what's it to you? And I said, it's funny, that's what my sponsor says. And I can remember once phoning my sponsor, and he said to me, in fact, I've got one here because it reminds me. He said, how much is a bus ticket anyway? And I said, 2 1/4. And he'd say, so you're selling your serenity for $2.25? I said, well, I didn't want to look at it that way. You've got to hate these people. He's still my sponsor. He's still the guy I texted half an hour ago. So this, she would say to me, practice. What are you going to do when you pull up? What route are you on? And I'd tell her, and she says, oh, there's some real corners there where you get some stops that nobody pays, isn't there? I says, yes. She said, well, here's what you do. You pull up to that stop, and you look them in the eye, and you say, welcome aboard. Do you need a ticket? And she said, practice, because it's not going to come easy to you. And I'd say, okay, I'll practice. And I would see that person every morning for about 4 months. We were doing the same shift. And she'd say to me, what are you going to do this morning? I'd say, welcome aboard. Do you need a free ticket? And that took me at least 6 months. At least 6 months. And then suddenly I was standing next to Jesse, I'll call her, and another driver came up, and he was complaining about somebody who wanted to get on the bus with a little dog under her arm. And what would you do? And she looked at me, and wanting me to answer, and I just looked at this guy, and I said, just say welcome aboard. And because it doesn't matter. You know, it's about Owen's serenity. You know, but I had all these built up resentments that I'd been packing around in this big suitcase forever. You know, I had expectations that people would pay. And we know expectations are premeditated resentments, and I had lots of them. But you know, my higher power puts me where I need to be. Not where I want to be necessarily, but later on, I guess it's where I needed to be. I used to drive down the bus lane in Vancouver. It's bus lane between 7 and 9:30 a.m., don't you know? So when I'm going down Hastings Street and I'm looking in my big rear view mirrors and there's cars coming behind me, because they're not supposed to be there, don't you know? It's Owen's lane. It's not just a bus lane. It's mine for another hour and a quarter. And so I'd watch them and they run. And you can be in that lane if you're making the first right-hand turn. So I'd watch them. And they didn't make that first right-hand turn. Okay. The next block would come along. And I'd watch the lights. And just as it's just getting into yellow, I'd slowly go across the intersection into the next bus stop, leaving the bumper of the bus just over the crosswalk. So this guy that's now coming down the bus lane for 4 blocks is stuck in the intersection with nowhere to go, and the car's coming this way are honking at him. And if you want to know how to do that better, you can find that on page... No, you don't find that in here. It's nowhere to be found in How Al-Anon Works. It's not step anything. It still annoys me, but now I don't let them get stuck out in the intersection. Because I have been a car going downtown one day when I was doing the main bus, and I had my wife said, would you come pick me up after work? Sure, and I went down lane one. I got to the intersection of Main and Terminal, and it's right turn only. Oh, well, I'll go straight ahead. And wasn't there Vancouver police on the other side? And so I moved the seatbelt across. I had my work jacket on. I moved the seatbelt across, and he went, oh, one of you guys. I said, well, I was driving the main bus all day. I said, I just got in this lane. He said, just remember for next time, will you? You know, when you're in your car, you're not supposed to be in this lane, and off I went. And it was an accident. But now I realize that, oh, maybe I can get away with that if I've got my uniform on. But you know, it's a matter of where does my higher power want me? You know, I didn't want to be a bus driver. Now I'm trying to figure out what year can we retire on this pension that they're going to give me. You know, I was going to do a lot of things different when I was 17, 18 years old. And I laid on the grass in the summertime and looked up at the clouds and the blue sky. I had bigger hopes and dreams. I was never going to be standing in Salmon Arm. I might have driven through Salmon Arm, but I was never going to be sharing a meal here with people that would reach out. But here I am, and I'm enjoying every moment of it. You know, where else do I get to be? I first got here 20-some years ago, and I didn't know how long I wanted to stay. And that's why when I bought this book at Booktown for $8.95, secondhand, because it was $20 back then, and there's only 12 steps, so why would I spend $20 on a book I'm not going to need for that long? But I still got it. It goes everywhere with me. You know, it's my lifeline. I remember a fellow in AA that I was in a conference with once, recovery seminar type thing, and he said when he first got sober with a group, he used to pick the phone up and say, "Hi, my name's B, I'm just practicing, goodbye." And he said, I would do that once a day. And when I got to Al-Anon, I thought, I better do that too. And even to this day, I'll do that with my sponsor. I'll phone him once a week or more, but I'll sometimes say, I'm just practicing because I don't really want to talk to you. And often, when I dial his number thinking, oh, I know he's out of town and I won't get him and any answers, I go, oh, damn, you're there. He said, oh, having a good day, are you? I said, yeah. He said, well, what's going on? I said, well, I don't know, whatever it is, you know. But it works. It works because I'm willing to do what's been done by people before me. And I used to do this all by myself. You know, when I got here, the things I remember the most is my first sponsor saying to me, you know, when I said to him, my father had a drinking problem. And he said, no, your father doesn't spill his drinks. He doesn't have a drinking problem. Why are you in Al-Anon? And you guys taught me the reason I'm in Al-Anon is because when I look in the mirror, my qualifying reason is looking right back at me. There's no other family members that I need to know or point the finger at to tell me to be here. I'm here because I was born in the family I'm in. We have the family disease of alcoholism. When I was born, I needed glasses. I didn't know that till grade 3 when all the kids in the neighborhood said I couldn't read the big E. But I don't blame my parents for that. So why would I blame them because one of them drank? You know, my father passed away before my mother, 2 years before. And you guys taught me how to have that relationship with my father that I never thought I was ever going to have. A fellow in my home group used to say that he had a daughter and a son, and his son was in AA, and he said, we can't get together, my son and I. He said, but we can play a game of golf, and we can be in fellowship for a game of golf. And I thought, what can I do with my father? Well, my father used to like to play crib. And so I said to him one day, about 10 years before he died probably, I said to him one day, would you like to play a game of crib? And he said, oh, I'd love to. So we started playing a couple, three games of crib every time we got together. And then one day I was sitting with him playing crib, and it was a white table out in the sun. And he knew how to play crib immensely well. And he had like a peg 12, and he says, I've got 12 in my hand, and he pulled the peg out of the board, and he went 12, and he put the peg in the 13th hole. And then that same game, that same day, that happened again. He got 6 or whatever, and he pulled the peg out, and he went 6 and put the peg in the next hole. And I said to him, hang on, you put it in the wrong hole. And then it happened again. And I went, that's what you got. Because I knew it wasn't about playing a game of crib or winning or losing. It was about having a relationship with my father that I would never have had without these 12 steps. I would never have had the moments that I had with him in his last few years of his life, playing crib and remembering. I was there the day he died. He died in the hospice care and mission, and I was able to be there and hold his hand. In fact, the day he died was Easter Monday, and I phoned that friend of mine in Australia, John, that taught me the word of fellowship. I phoned him that morning and said, "Oh, Dad's in hospice." And I said, "I'm going out to see him this afternoon." And he said, "Well, what time is it in Canada now?" And I said, "Well, it's about 10 o'clock in the morning." He said, "Why are you waiting until this afternoon?" I said, "Well, I don't think I've got that much to say to him, and he can't play crib. So I'm not sure." And John said to me, "Just hang the phone up and go and visit your father." And I went out that day, and that's the day he passed away. And I was able to be there and hold his hand when he died. And 2 years later, my mom passed away, and I was able to be there when she passed away. And at both their services, I was able to stand up at the podium in the church and say, "My name is Owen, and I'm grateful to be my parents' son." Afterwards, my wife said to me, "I thought you were going to say I was grateful to be an Al-Anon member." And I said, "I had to say something that reminded me, though, of being an Al-Anon." So I said, "I was proud to be my father's son." And I was in that moment, and still am today. And same as my mother. And I wouldn't have those moments unless you guys had taught me how to be there and how to stick my hand out and say, "My name's Owen, and welcome." So I want to thank you again. I'm looking at the clock thinking I've got a minute to close. And I could go on for another half. When I stood up here, I thought, gosh, there's nearly an hour to go. And now I've got stories I can go on, but I'm not. But I want to say thank you for allowing me to come and spend an hour with you, spend a weekend with you, and for your listening to me. And if there's something I said here that's been helpful to you, well, then my God has blessed me with those words to give you. They're not mine. It's great to just stand here for a moment and look out and say thank you very much for my serenity, knowing what the serenity prayer is now, and understanding that I can have relationships now that have full meaning, and I can be welcomed in rooms like this. So thank you very much. Yeah.